Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Clinician's Guide to Treating Adult Children of Narcissists, Pulling Back the Curtain on Manipulation, Gaslighting, and Emotional Abuse in Narcissistic Families. By Amy Marlowe McCoy, MED, LPC, with Amy Kemp, MS, LPC, NCC, CSAT. Narrated by Emily Durante. Publisher's note. This audiobook includes bonus material. Please visit Tantor.com and type The Clinician's Guide to Treating Adult Children of Narcissists into the search box. Follow the link to the book's page, then under the supplemental content section, please enter the access code THERAPY, and then click the unlock button to access the bonus material. The code should be entered in all lowercase letters. All figures and appendices referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. Introduction. Imagine entering a therapy office for the first time in your life. After years, decades even, of wondering what was wrong with you, you have gathered the courage to sit down with a perfect stranger and share your life story in the hope of finding some relief. Imagine inviting this stranger into your reality and sharing your story with them, the story you hid from yourself for years until you were forced to face your truth, the story that's been hurting you from the inside for all this time, the life story in which you were the victim of someone else's black hole of needs, the one in which you were raised by a narcissist. Now imagine pouring out your heart to this perfect stranger sitting in the therapist chair, hoping they will hear you, validate you, and help you understand what has happened to you, only to hear them tell you that you're wrong. I can absolutely validate that you feel hurt by some of your mother's parenting choices, but I don't know if it's fair to label her a narcissist. Real narcissists are extremely rare, actually. You know, a lot of people use words like narcissist and gaslighting, but those are nowhere near as common as social media makes out. Your father probably didn't mean it that way. Don't take it to heart. A lot of men just aren't socialized to be emotionally attuned. I can hear that you feel very hurt by the way your parents raised you. Parents are humans too, and we all make mistakes. I wonder how it benefits you to hold on to your resentment instead of moving on from the past. I really can't support cutting off family members. There is always a chance to improve the relationship if we keep trying. Let's have a family session and see where you can compromise so you can all be reconciled. After all, relationships are a two-way street. To make yourself so vulnerable as to share the reality of growing up with an emotionally abusive, manipulative, and immature parent is a gut-wrenchingly scary step. To take that step and then be invalidated by the person you have gone to for healing is not only pouring salt in the wound, it's a slap to the face. Sadly, this is the reality for many survivors of narcissistic abuse who seek therapy to heal from their toxic families of origin. Time and time again, we have heard the same story. A client reaches out for help to heal from narcissistic abuse, only to be inadvertently gaslighted and invalidated by a well-meaning therapist who doesn't have a deep enough understanding of narcissistic relationships. Many clinicians are underprepared to work with adult children of narcissists because they are only familiar with narcissism as it is depicted in pop culture and social media. Most of those depictions are overly simplified, casting the narcissist as a scheming villain out to ruin their victims' lives, or absolving them of all wrongdoing in the face of the narcissist's own trauma history. Some depictions are more of a caricature than an accurate portrayal of the complex humanity that even the most self-absorbed narcissist contains. In addition, there is a relative lack of resources clearly outlining and describing the dynamics of narcissistic abuse, and graduate education programs typically underemphasize the scale and impact of narcissism in relationships. As a result, clinicians often brush aside descriptions of a narcissistic loved one, which does a grave disservice to clients whose family members do not match the mental image of a narcissist, but whose emotional abuse and manipulation leave equally deep wounds. While most everyone can relate to having someone dismiss, downplay, or question their reality, this experience is especially painful for adult children of narcissists because they carry a lifetime of being told that their feelings are wrong, their memories are unreliable, and their perceptions are flawed. They have been raised to believe that they are in the wrong in any disagreement. Being invalidated yet again by a therapist, someone with all the presumed authority of knowledge and expertise, can be a devastating blow to a client's sense of self. As clinicians, we have the power to further undermine our clients' self-trust or to be a strong source of support, affirmation, and acceptance. If we attempt to treat adult children of narcissists without fully understanding the full scope of the issues they face, including complex developmental trauma, deep attachment wounds, ingrained shame and guilt, and lack of self-identity, to name just a few, we put our clients at risk. We play into the continuation of the abuse cycle without realizing it. But if we can understand our clients' lived experiences and validate their reality, we have an opportunity to be the first source of emotional safety that they have ever encountered. That is what we are here to do with this clinician's guide, to help you gain a deeper understanding of narcissistic abuse so you can support clients in healing from it. In this book, you will find the tools and resources you need to understand and explore a client's experience of love bombing, devaluation, triangulation, gaslighting, hoovering, and more, so you can fully support them in healing from this relational abuse. We provide thorough, in-depth description of what narcissistic abuse looks like, how it harms clients, and what differentiates narcissistic abuse from other forms of family conflict. We have also woven in a variety of client stories to illustrate what treating narcissistic abuse can look like in practice. In addition, we have included an appendix, which can be found in the accompanying bonus materials, containing several handouts and worksheets to aid you in applying these concepts to your work with clients. We wrote this book to assist clinicians who work closely with adult children of narcissists, including but not limited to licensed professional counselors, social workers, marriage and family therapists, eating disorder treatment teams, clinical educators and supervisors, psychiatrists, psychologists, substance abuse treatment teams. The work of healing from narcissistic abuse is deep and complex, as conversations about narcissism in personal and global contexts increase. The need for well-trained and experienced specialists is greater than ever. Caring, competent, and well-prepared clinicians can be instrumental in changing a client's life when they truly understand the depth of the issues and dynamics at play. Having worked closely with this population for many years, we are honored to have gathered the wisdom of our clients, as well as our own experiences, and to share what we have learned with you. It is our hope that in listening to this book, you will feel the same sense of respect, compassion, and pride in these clients that we do. We also hope that it will allow you to become one of those therapists with whom these clients can feel safe to speak their truth. Because there is nothing in the world quite like the feeling that someone, somewhere, finally gets it. Part 1. Understanding Narcissistic Abuse. Client Story, Lydia. Lydia began seeing Marcel for therapy when she was 27 years old. Marcel's first impression of Lydia was of a thoughtful, intelligent young woman full of nervous energy and curiosity. When she entered Marcel's office, she responded positively to his warm welcome, the tension in her shoulders easing ever so slightly as he invited her to find a seat on the couch. As they settled into the get-to-know-yous of a first therapy session, Lydia identified the concerns that had led her to call Marcel: a difficult breakup, low self-esteem, lifelong anxiety, and dissatisfaction with her body. "I think I need to deal with my anxiety," Lydia began. "I just got out of a long-term relationship, and I can't stop replaying everything that happened. I know Scott, my ex, did things wrong too, but I feel like if I weren't so anxious all the time, I would be easier to be with. Lydia could easily list all of her own flaws and expressed concern that her inability to make her most recent relationship work meant she would end up alone, a deep fear that she had rarely voiced until now. I tried so hard to make it work with Scott, so hard, and for it to fall apart anyway and be alone again at 27 makes me feel like I'll never be good enough for anyone. Marcelle's ears perked up at that phrase, never be good enough. From the way her body language shifted and the quiet defeat in Lydia's voice, it was clear that this belief was deeply ingrained. It was also clear that it had taken root long before she met Scott. Curious, he made a mental note to track this in future sessions. The early sessions. Lydia's first several sessions were primarily focused on coping with her breakup. As she processed the grief and loss of the relationship falling apart, Marcel noticed Lydia had a habit of questioning her own memories, feelings, and experiences. When he pointed this out, her eyes teared up. "Well, it's true. I don't trust myself. I thought Scott was a good guy, different from my other exes. He was so sweet and attentive in the beginning. I was totally swept off my feet. I fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. Obviously, that didn't work out, so my judgment can't be trusted." Lydia then outlined other data points to support her own unreliability, such as becoming overly upset when Scott came home hours later than promised, or feeling hurt when he made teasing remarks about her weight. "Can we check that out for a minute?" Marcel asked, slowing Lydia in her litany of self-criticism. "What is wrong with feeling upset about him being late without telling you, or making jokes you find hurtful?" The surprise and confusion on Lydia's face confirmed Marcel's hunch that she had been a victim of frequent gaslighting. This conversation marked the beginning of a different phase of Lydia's processing, as Marcel explained what gaslighting, manipulation, and emotional abuse might look like in a relationship. "Maybe that's why I felt almost relieved when the relationship finally died," Lydia pondered. "I thought that was just more proof that something is wrong with me, that even though I was sad about breaking up, I also felt freer." Marcel nodded, pleased to see her consider the possibility that her intuition was correct, rather than shutting herself down immediately. Her eyes took on a faraway look as she sat with the possibility. "That would make a lot of sense," Marcel said, validating her ambivalence. "I'm curious. You looked for a moment like you were thinking about something else other than Scott. Have you ever experienced any of the patterns we talked about in any other relationships?" It was a little risky, calling attention to the signs of slight dissociation he'd noticed, but Marcel was confident in their rapport and in Lydia's willingness to explore new insights. Lydia paused, briefly looking far away again, before nodding slowly. "I guess it kind of reminds me of how I feel with my mom," she said after a long pause. "Our mother-daughter relationship has always been complicated. She's not abusive. She's actually very loving and my biggest cheerleader, but for some reason I keep thinking about her when we talk about Scott." There it is, Marcel thought. And so the next phase of Lydia's process began as they took a closer look at her relationship with her mother, Evelyn. Going deeper. Although Lydia described Evelyn as a loving mother, she also made reference to her mean side, in which Evelyn would become viciously critical of Lydia, particularly if she thought Lydia was getting a big head or feeling too proud of herself. Lydia's friends and teachers were rarely exposed to this side of Evelyn because in public, she appeared to be the most devoted and vocal supporter Lydia could ask for. She told everyone, including Lydia's friends and teachers, that Lydia could easily become the President of the United States one day. In private, though, Evelyn had another side. In addition, Evelyn emphasized the importance of outward appearances and frequently commented on Lydia's changing body as she went through puberty. One time, Evelyn even gave Lydia a book on weight loss as a birthday gift. A competitive swimmer in high school, Lydia had always maintained a strong, fit physique, but frequently worried about her size. Lydia's lifelong body image concerns now made even more sense, although she had never really considered her mother as a source of those concerns.
"I think she just didn't want me to gain too much weight because it might affect my swimming," Lydia said. "It hurt my feelings, but I was also really sensitive as a kid. It probably wasn't as bad as I remember."
Here, again, Marcel could see evidence of the gaslighting she had experienced over the years, causing Lydia to blame herself for feeling hurt, rather than holding her mother responsible for saying those hurtful things in the first place. This time, Marcel felt Lydia was ready to confront the issue more directly. "Sometimes it doesn't matter what the other person intended," he said calmly. "If your mom's advice was hurtful, your feelings are valid, regardless of what she intended." Lydia's discomfort was immediately palpable as she froze in her seat and stared at Marcel.
"I can't be mad at her," Lydia said, somewhat defensively. "She did so much for me as a single mom. She did her best, and I love her."
Lydia's resistance gave Marcel another piece of important information, that acknowledging her mother's words as hurtful immediately triggered guilt, shame, and a need to defend Evelyn. Trusting their rapport, he gently pressed a little more.
"Okay, I hear that it's really hard to talk about how your mom might have hurt you," he gently reflected. "I'm wondering what feels wrong about that. Do you think it's possible to love someone and acknowledge the ways they have hurt you?"
Lydia's knuckles turned white as she squeezed her hands tightly together and bit her lips.
"I don't know," she finally said, very quietly. "It makes sense in my head, but it doesn't feel right to talk about her like this. I feel like I'm not giving her enough credit for how hard she tried, and it feels wrong to complain about her to you. Mom used to get really upset if I told anyone what she said about my body or about the diet book. She said talking about stuff like that outside was airing our dirty laundry and low class."
A few more pieces of the puzzle clicked into place as Lydia spoke. The secrecy, the feeling of disloyalty when she spoke about her mother's hurtful behaviors, the conditioning to paint her mother in the best possible light. Marcel's suspicions were confirmed. Lydia was almost certainly the adult child of a narcissistic parent. The heart of the pain. Lydia struggled with feelings of guilt and shame as she slowly allowed herself to acknowledge how her mother had hurt her. She ricocheted back and forth between feeling rage at the critical things Evelyn told her and feeling remorse for talking badly about her mother. To help her process these conflicting feelings, Marcel and Lydia spent a great deal of time practicing yes and sentences. Yes, Evelyn was a single parent who tried her best, and she also said and did things that were deeply hurtful. Yes, Evelyn attended every swim practice and meet to support Lydia, and she was relentlessly critical of Lydia's performances every time. Yes, Evelyn purchased trendy clothes and accessories for Lydia to wear to school, and she sometimes purchased them a size too small to motivate Lydia to go on another diet. Eventually, Lydia's impulse to defend her mother gave way to the heartbreaking questions every adult child of a narcissist must confront sooner or later.
Why couldn't she just love me? Why couldn't I just be her daughter instead of having to be this star athlete and straight-A student? What do I have to do to make her happy? Will I ever be good enough?
With these questions, Lydia gradually moved into the heartbreaking but honest acceptance that her mother had emotionally manipulated and abused her throughout her life. With acceptance, Lydia began to separate herself from the idealized version of Evelyn as the heroic single parent that she'd held for so long. Instead, she began to see Evelyn more realistically, as someone whose relational patterns and behaviors had caused Lydia deep
pain. And with this acceptance came the next step of healing. Grieving the loss of the protective fantasy of Evelyn she had created, and grieving the lack of an emotionally nurturing, healthy parent. Growing through grief. Lydia's grief was intense, prolonged, and deeply painful. As she worked through her sadness, bitterness, anger, and betrayal, she gradually began to shed the conditioned instinct to protect Evelyn's image from scrutiny. She began to see more clearly who her mother was and how their relationship had influenced the way she saw herself. Seeing Evelyn's narcissistic traits more clearly gave Lydia insight into why her other relationships, such as the one with Scott, had caused her such pain. As she learned to recognize the patterns of narcissistic abuse, she could now begin to make different choices in her relationships instead of falling into the same traps she had before. Instead of immediately reacting to her mom's demands, she now could pause and make a thoughtful choice for herself. As her ability to self-regulate in the face of pressure and manipulation grew, her self-confidence and assertiveness also grew. Over time, Lydia learned to trust herself more deeply. Of course, no grieving or healing process is linear. Lydia slipped into old patterns at times. For example, after receiving a negative review at work, she went into a downward spiral of self-doubt, self-criticism, and anxiety. She fixated on the negative comments in the performance review, viewing them as a reflection of her personal worth, and spent days identifying every imperfection she needed to address. But with each slip, she learned more about where she was vulnerable to manipulation. She learned where her unhealed attachment wounds lingered, and she learned that she was stronger and more resilient than she had ever believed. Lydia could not have known when she entered Marcel's office for that first session that the journey she was embarking on would lead where it did. Marcel couldn't have known from her initial request that the heart of their work would ultimately revolve around healing from a narcissistic parent. If they had only focused on coping with her breakup with Scott, Lydia would have just scratched the surface of the healing she needed. Fortunately, in recognizing the subtle signs of narcissistic abuse that peeked through Lydia's story, Marcel was able to help her go much deeper. In the following chapter, we will discuss some of those signs so that you too can recognize them in your clients. Let's begin. Chapter 1. What is Narcissistic Abuse? Defining Narcissism and Narcissistic Abuse. Narcissistic abuse doesn't exist in the latest edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and any two people could give different descriptions of this phenomenon. Narcissism can also wear many faces and present in a number of ways, which makes it difficult to pinpoint a single, easy-to-identify definition of this nuanced issue. We need some guidelines, however, to clarify what we are actually discussing when we talk about narcissistic abuse. With that in mind, we have defined it as follows. Narcissistic abuse. A persistent pattern of manipulative, abusive, and controlling behaviors that occur within a relationship, with the primary goal being the promotion of the narcissist's well-being at the expense and to the detriment of others. It can be tempting to write off the concept of narcissistic abuse as a pop culture phenomenon that does not have any real clinical value. The lack of a singular, empirically supported definition of narcissistic abuse may seem to support this perception. We disagree. In the field of psychotherapy, we clinicians sometimes become hyper-focused on empirical data as the determinant of a concept's validity. There is a reason for that, as our field has had to work hard to get acknowledgement and recognition from the harder sciences. The problem lies in relying too heavily on data-driven processes that try to quantify human experiences. Not all experiences are quantifiable, but all human experiences are real and valid. Therefore, we encourage you to remain open to more nuanced conversations about narcissism that occur in all kinds of settings, rather than limiting yourself to the DSM criteria for narcissistic personality disorder. Having said that, since narcissism and narcissistic abuse are not always easy to quantify, where do we draw the line between a narcissist and a non-narcissist? Simply put, we don't. It is far more helpful and realistic to consider narcissism as a spectrum of behaviors and traits than a series of discrete boxes to check off. All humans have some narcissistic traits: self-interest, external locus of control, ambition, or pride. These traits are not inherently negative, but they have the potential to cause great harm when they are expressed in ways that hurt, exploit, or devalue others. For example, in many cultures, high self-esteem and positive self-image are considered valuable qualities. But when combined with a sense of entitlement and lack of empathy, they can become harmful and abusive. Self-confidence is not inherently harmful, but can become so when it is used to dominate or overpower others. Positive self-image is not a problem on its own, but can become so when used to devalue others, or when it is so brittle that any critique or lack of admiration is tantamount to an attack. For clinicians who like having clear-cut parameters for diagnosis and definition, the spectrum of narcissism can be a challenging concept to embrace. We encourage you to cultivate a flexible mindset that conceptualizes narcissistic personality traits on a gradient. Recognizing that these traits may not always meet the criteria for a diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder should not be a reason to dismiss a client's description of their loved one as narcissistic. Embracing the flexibility of assessing traits as opposed to diagnosing another person allows you to meet clients where they are and validate their lived experience without getting derailed by incomplete diagnostic criteria. The many faces of narcissism, subtypes and presentations. One of the most promising branches of contemporary clinical research on narcissism is the growing awareness that there are many potential faces of narcissism. Although many of our current diagnostic guidelines for narcissistic personality disorder are skewed toward clients with the grandiose subtype, who are easy to identify because their oversized sense of entitlement, shameless demands for admiration, and larger-than-life personalities draw our eyes to them. This is only one form of a narcissistic personality. There are two additional faces of narcissism that are equally important to consider: the vulnerable and malignant subtypes. In addition, while some researchers distinguish narcissistic personality on the basis of subtype, grandiose, vulnerable, or malignant, others do so by presentation, overt or covert. Still others use the terms interchangeably. Therefore, in the following section, we will explore each of these subtypes in more detail, including which presentations are commonly linked to each subtype. Being aware of these many faces of narcissism can make the difference between stopping or perpetuating a cycle of abuse. Grandiose subtype. The most commonly recognized form of narcissism is the grandiose subtype, given that it is associated with bombastic, over-the-top, and openly self-aggrandizing behavior. For this reason, it should come as no surprise that grandiose narcissism often corresponds with an overt presentation. Grandiose narcissists engage in flashy displays of wealth and power, expect special treatment from others, and present themselves with an exceptionally confident demeanor. They are also quick to anger and are willing to be perceived as domineering or argumentative as long as they get what they want. They can be extraordinarily charming and persuasive, and their extroverted personalities may afford them success in the public sector, such as in the competitive business world or politics, but their public persona can differ sharply from their private one. For adult children of grandiose narcissists, it can be galling to see others react in adoration to their parents' public persona with no awareness of what happens behind closed doors. Client story, Natalie.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?